Today is Thursday. It's December 3rd, 2020, the worst year ever. Oh, it's getting a little bit better. Hi, I'm John Williams. It's 1:34 in the afternoon. This is the Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record from throughout Chicagoland via Zoom. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the Tribune columnist who is not running for Illinois Secretary of State.
Only Austin Berg thinks he can make a sexy conversation out of the run-up for Secretary of State.
I did not say that.
You were wooing the idea.
Although, I don't know if that was at the story itself, but I think Heather has would have some interesting coverage of it, depending on who gets involved in the race.
Yeah, I mean, so Jesse White said last time around he wasn't going to run again, and then he ran again. So most people seem to think that he won't run again this time because he's in his, like, late 80s at this point, which leaves a vacuum in a statewide office. So you've got Democrats lining up left and right, including Alderman Walter Burnett, who is part of Jesse White's political organization, as well as Cook County Clerk Karen Yarborough. And I mentioned that I was a little bit surprised to see that Karen Yarborough was tossing her hat in the ring, because her office is one of the few remaining county offices that remains under oversight by a court for violating court orders to prevent patronage. And in fact, they stepped up their oversight of her office in recent months, just before the pandemic hit. I guess she's looking forward to more coverage of those issues. And I'm always happy to write about the Shachtman decree because I am a nerd.
Is she the one who was complaining when she got her security detail yanked?
No, that was Melissa Conyers-Irvin, the city treasurer.
Okay. Well, Jesse White famously has an elaborate security detail, which just kind of cracks me up. Like, really, who's going to go after the Secretary of State? It's just like a perk. He's surrounded by guys with earpieces and black SUVs, and he gives out driver's license. I mean, I think this is not a knock on his job performance, but come on.
You try going into these high schools with these tumblers and see how much security you need. All this clamoring team.
Well, the other name that's really prominent in this race that John Williams doesn't care about is Alexei Janulius, the former state treasurer and former European professional basketball player. But he's got a lot of money, and I think he's got some political talent.
He has been relegated to a appointed position on the Chicago Public Library Board of Trustees at this point. So yeah. I don't know about that. But
that's super sexy. Who doesn't want that? That's a springboard.
That's a special edition of the Mincing Rascals.
But you know, back in 2012, you know, his Senate run sort of foundered on his connection to Blagojevich. And like, there were real questions about his family's running of Broadway Bank and sort of how that was all caught up with Blagojevich and everything else.
Do you think Jesse White will have any influence or sway as to who his successor will be? Is he going to go around and try to anoint a single candidate or do any work behind the scenes? Was that his style?
I mean, he's an old school machine politician, and the way that old school machine politicians leave office is to resign and anoint their successor and then have that successor run in the election. So I wouldn't rule that out at all. And I think Pritzker, the governor, of course, would probably, you know, do what he told him to do, especially because of the whole, you know, Pritzker being caught on tape with Blagojevich talking about African-American politicians and referring to Jesse White as a quote unquote clean politician. I mean, it's just good. I mean, that would just be a mess for Pritzker to go against Jesse White.
The field that's forming is very much qualified to take the position because a lot of them. So Giannoulias, I got a text right when he announced from a friend that said, quote, "So Giannoulias is getting back into politics. I'm sure my effing mobbed up cousins are going to be rewarded handsomely."
Allegedly.
And Yarbrough similarly is not that similarly, but has had a lot of patronage concerns. And this is the patronage office of Illinois. It's thousands of jobs. Right. Edgar was in it. Ryan was in it. You build a political patronage power base from this office, and then you run for governor. It's not surprising the character's coming out of the woodwork right now to run for this office.
Yeah, that's the three things when I think about the Secretary of State's office, that it's patronage, that it's a springboard to the governorship and that it's a springboard to jail.
I've got to say, I feel like Jesse White has done a pretty good job in the basic functions, the ministerial functions of being Secretary of State. It feels like he's done a pretty good job. I feel like the process when I've gone to renew my license or renew my plates has been fine. I think his press staff is really responsive, and it's just. But you have Dave Drucker on your show a lot, don't you, John? Or you did?
He's a nice guy. Takes a beating sometimes when he comes on because people are worried about their real ID. Pre-COVID, that was what talk radio was about. Jesse is one of those guys, though. Well, they'll come into the studio to be interviewed, and the staff looks a little tortured because they know the answers, and a lot of them he doesn't know. So there's a lot of shuffling of papers and whispering loudly of information because Jesse's a popular person, maybe, but really a figurehead.
It's also one of those quirks of Illinois law that not only does he run the driver services facility, and I will correct you if you refer to it as a DMV and send you back to California or wherever you came from, but he also runs our elections. And I know we've talked on the show about how important our elections are, and election administration has really been in the spotlight, you know, and I think it's a question, you know, should the same guy who's in charge of driver's licenses be in charge of automatic voter registration and election administration?
Well, we're the only state that does that, yeah. Right?
Georgia, famously, the Secretary of State there right now. I mean, this is right. Something that I had the same kind of thought process that Heather did, which was that when the Secretary of State in Georgia was coming under all this fire, I was going, oh yeah, that's right. The Secretary of State oversees elections because they don't. It's not an obvious connection here. You don't see Jesse White's name on the ballot. Or anything. So Heather is right. But that can be a very important position if you have a zesty election.
Speaking of Georgia politics, and by the way, this podcast is going not at all in the route that I had originally planned.
As usual.
The very sexy Secretary of State's race. And congratulations. I think you guys handled that well. But let's just, while we're in Georgia, talk about that Gabriel Sterling guy. I presume you saw his. At least from the first 5 minutes of his performance, I'll call it. He's a Republican. He is Georgia's voting system implementation manager. So you get the feeling that he's sort of in charge of the election down there. He literally shook with anger as he was describing threats to the people that were implementing the runoff for Senate in January, and also the challenges to the presidential vote down there. You know, they had over 5 million votes, and about 12,000 something was the difference. Joe Biden wins. The president is still telling people that he won the election, but there it is. But he had a couple of pretty good lines, and one of them was,
"It has to stop."
And I wondered if that was going to be remembered as the Senator, have you no decency, for the 2020 election, the moment where we said, this really is too gross.
My response was, it's rare to see a public official get that almost uncontrollably angry in front of cameras. He just must be under just unimaginable pressure. We know that all of these officials are basically in hiding now because they've all gotten death threats. Their families have gotten threats. Their children have gotten threats. You know, I wish I was as hopeful as you are, John, that it's going to break through. You know, I don't know that we could even have you no decency moment in our culture anymore.
It's a reminder that we have not seen these leading Republicans, especially Trump, but even Mitch McConnell, people like that, speak out against violence, against these threats. You're not hearing them remind people, we have a court system, we have an orderly way of appealing elections, of making our points without resorting to threats and violence. I haven't seen that renunciation. I thought the speech was wonderful and powerful, and I resonated with it, but it really does draw into sharp relief the fact that we have not heard that message from leading Republicans, which is like, let's turn the temperature down on this. If for some fluke miracle reason we can decide that Donald Trump has won this election, we have to do it through legal means. We're not going to do it by surrounding the state Capitol building and honking horns and shouting with bullhorns and surrounding people's homes and threatening their families. That's not the way democracy works.
Well, that was the takeaway for me, too. I don't know how you felt about it, Austin, but when he said to you senators who are saying nothing,
"Senators, you have not condemned this language or these actions.
This has to stop. We need you to step up, and if you're going to take a position of leadership, show some.
I don't expect Donald Trump to change his tune, but you'd hope that there'd be a little more decency, if you will, among those members of the Senate.
This is the backbone of democracy, and all of you who have not said a damn word are complicit in this.
I liked how he said, basically, it looks, Mr. President, it looks like you likely lost the state of Georgia, but we're investigating. There's always a possibility, but that does not justify any of these calls for violence, and you have a responsibility to speak out against it. And I think that's totally reasonable. I think that's a totally reasonable request to people running for office in the state of Georgia.
Do you think that there's going to be a cloud over the next 4 years, not over the legitimacy of Joe Biden's win, but over the possibility that Trump will run again?
The New York Times had a great article yesterday about how many presidents who have served one term and then thought they could come back and win another term never actually did. I mean, it's only Grover Cleveland. And, you know, obviously that was a whole different era in national politics. And he also won the popular vote both times, which, of course, President Trump has never even come close to doing.
I was barely alive when Cleveland went. And I can't remember, did he actually lose a bid for re-election and then came back?
After fathering a child out of wedlock.
Shame.
Nice. Look who did her homework. My boy Teddy Roosevelt tried to run again and didn't go.
Right.
In our non-scientific survey, WGN radio listeners were asked what they would do if given the chance to send their kid to a Chicago public school in January or have them learn remotely. And still more than half of them are saying they would keep the kid home. I would send my child, I think, to school. The CPS CEO, Janice Jackson, told us about the metric. I thought this was interesting. They were going to use to judge whether or not they would shut the schools back down again after the first of the year. And it wasn't by a positivity rate, but by a doubling rate, which presumes, right, that the virus is going to be there. More kids are going to get infected because they're there. And all we're going to do is hope that it doesn't double at such a rate that it's too risky. It's too dangerous. So that's the environment that we're sending them in. But I guess that's the environment everybody is in. That's the environment you and I are in when we go to the grocery store and when basketball players play basketball. This is a hypothetical for me, but I'm going to say I send my kid to school. Heather, what are you going to do?
Well, it's not hypothetical for me because I have a sixth grader and a third grader, and we live in Park Ridge, and the Park Ridge Public Schools offered hybrid for about a month, from about mid-October to about mid-December, and we didn't send them back. Part of it is because my job is looking at these numbers every day, and I could tell by mid-October that we were going in the wrong direction. And even if they did go back, it wasn't going to be for very much longer. But it's also a function of my privilege. You know, they have steady internet, they have devices, and they're doing relatively well, which is all anybody should expect at this point with remote learning. But if I had younger kids, if I couldn't work while they were going to school at home, if they were suffering socially or academically more than they're suffering right now, I don't know what I would do. But the easy choice is to keep them home and to keep them safe, and so that I don't have to worry about them, you know, being exposed.
Yeah, I mean, my hypothetical answer would be similar to the real answer that Heather is offering, which is that it would depend on the kid and depend on how the kids are doing. And if you sense they were really suffering, it also would depend on the kind of exposure that you would then be giving, say, to an elderly relative who lived in the house or in the neighborhood to whom they would be exposed a lot. Because this is clearly, if you look at the reported deaths, it's just still really ravaging an elderly population. And so if you have like a mother-in-law or something like that, a father-in-law living with you, that would be a real factor. I think it would be good for the schools to offer this hybrid option so that people can go who feel like they really need to do this. And it also seems to me that in places around the country where they have done this, they've managed to have schools be fairly safe. I haven't looked at all the data, but that's my understanding
as I
read the news, that schools have not proven to be nearly the same problem as a lot of other places have.
It seems like the preponderance of evidence right now is that they're just reflective of the community at large, and they are most likely not in and of themselves a large source of super spreading events. So and I think Heather got it spot on. I think the last number I saw was less than 1 in 5 Black workers can telework. and I think it's around 1 in 6 for Hispanic workers. So if you talk about a student and parent population like CPS, it would seem to, you almost have a moral obligation to offer at least some kind of hybrid model given the makeup of those workers. And the biggest example we've seen of this is New York public schools, which by no means have been smooth, but really large school district, much lower community transmission, at least right now, than Chicago, but have it seemingly had success with offering some kind of in-person schooling tool in a large city.
Back in the summer, Janice Jackson said, look, if we have more than 400 confirmed cases per day on average, it's not safe to go back to school. Today, we're averaging like 1,300 cases per day. And I have a hard time wrapping my brain around that. Like, what have we learned enough about the way that this virus affects kids to sort of say that we, you know, can so drastically change that metric? You know, I know that that's what keeps a lot of parents up at night.
What are the Archdiocese schools doing now? I know that they were in person and then they were pulling back some. I think they were offering a hybrid model. Do we know what they're going to be doing going into the next year?
All of the Archdiocese schools were back in person, and they're also doing like a pod situation where the kids are sort of kept together. So if one kid tests positive, the whole school doesn't have to shut down. But they also, after Thanksgiving, gave schools the option of staying remote until after the first of the year because of people travel and whatnot. But that was an option. So, you know, it's a weird situation. Like in Park Ridge, the two Catholic schools are open. They haven't changed, but the public schools are back fully remote. That's why you hear people like Mayor Lightfoot and Janice Jackson, the CPS CEO, saying this is an equity issue. If rich, primarily white kids get to go to school in person and are having better academic outcomes, you know, we have to sort of figure out a way to make this happen for poor Black and Latino kids who don't have those resources.
Well, Heather, you're the numbers nerd. Tell me how alarmed I should be at this report of 238 deaths that were announced on Wednesday.
So I don't think you should be specifically alarmed by any one data point. So that's what I tell people who ask me that question. So that 238 deaths was from several delayed days after Thanksgiving, because the way it works is that hospitals report their deaths to county health agencies, and then those county health agencies report that to IDPH. So when you have a holiday like Thanksgiving, when everything shuts down, everything gets slower. So that's several days of sort of backlogged data. I have been focusing mostly on the number of cases because that tells you how likely you are in the wild to meet somebody with COVID-19 in the wild, so to speak. So in Chicago right now, 1 in 19 people has COVID-19. So that's a lot.
There's that Facebook group, too, that is for the restaurants that are still open in violation of the governor's order. And I was looking at that. In fact, I was invited to join the group. Damn, there's a lot of restaurants on there. And, you know, after Thanksgiving, people were calling in on the radio saying, well, a lot of restaurants are still open. And I'm like, no, they're not. And they go, yes, they are. And then I looked at this Facebook group and pick a suburb, pick a town. There's half a dozen restaurants just everywhere that are open. I guess that's no revelation to anybody, but I was a little surprised at the brazenness of that. I will say this, though. Most of the restaurants on that list are not Let Us Entertain You. They're not big chain restaurants that have corporate money behind them. It's mom and pop shops mostly, I think, that, you know, if they don't break the law, they won't survive anyway. So what have they got to lose? I think there's a little bit of that attitude.
I think that's totally part of it. I've been reading this book. It's called How Behavior Spreads. It's by this UPenn sociologist. It's got a bunch of good like public health stuff in it. And one of the kind of insights from that is when you look at a lot of in developing countries, when people are trying to do public health interventions like safe sex or taking a certain pill every day, it can be very difficult because the perceived risk of the disease itself is less than 10 million other risks that the person faces on a daily basis. So it's like for a lot of people in Illinois, you could expect like, well, COVID is maybe number 5 on the things I'm worried about because I've got gang violence in my neighborhood. I have other health issues anyways, and I'm in extreme poverty, and you know, it's the ladder goes up. And I think you're totally right. For a lot of these restaurant owners, it's basically I do this or my entire business dies and all of my employees are fired. So let's roll the dice. I think it's
completely different. And of course, they are offering only the opportunity for other people to take the risk, right? I'm sure that's another way that they can justify it, which is like, I need to do this to keep myself alive, but I'm just opening my doors. I'm not dragging people in off the street and breathing on them. I am inviting them to assess their own risk and come in and do that. I mean, of course,
that gets them off the hook, Eric.
No. I'm saying the problem with that kind of thinking is that especially for younger people, the risk is not them getting it nearly so much as it is them spreading it. It's more like firing your gun in the air on New Year's Eve. Like the bullet's probably not going to come down and hit you on the head, but it might come down and hit somebody else on the head. That's a bad analogy, but I'll stick with it.
There's also a question of enforcement, right? Like Chicago's BACP is out there sort of investigating calls, like, and they're shutting people down after egregious violations, but that's not happening in DuPage. That's not happening in McHenry County. So it's sort of, if I own a restaurant and if it's, am I going to go completely out of business and not be able to pay my mortgage? Or if I stay open and nobody's going to come yell at me and maybe somebody gets sick and maybe somebody doesn't get sick, like that's the gamble that they're taking. And, you know, I don't want to say it's understandable, but that's their thought process.
Well, there was a lot of attention to those two mega parties, 300 people, 600 people, and those, I guess, essentially got busted. I don't know what the consequences are, but evidently we found out about it. And then there was that Northbrook. Was it Northbrook? There was a big wedding, I guess, that took place over the weekend, and we're just hearing about that now. And
these restaurants that are violating the rules, are they just completely ignoring the rules, or are they just saying, we're going to open up, we'll have socially distanced dining, we're going to try to do this as safely as we can and still stay in business, which is a different thing than just saying, you know, nuts to you guys, nuts to this problem, come on in and chow down.
Well, a friend of mine went to a restaurant Saturday, exactly what we're talking about, and dined in the restaurant, and said it was like it was before we went to tier three, that it was spread out in masks. But that's like the mayor of Naperville all over again saying, I know we're not supposed to do it, but if I do it safely, it'll be okay. Have you noticed that's the new hot story CNN and everybody else is doing, outing especially Democrat mayors or governors, but politicians in general who are defying their own orders?
Well, was he the mayor of Austin, Texas? Yeah.
In Cabo St. Lucas. Cabo, he recorded a stay home Austin message, which, wow. Like, don't you have an aide who says, hey, Mr. Mayor, let's not?
Yeah. And the mayor of San Francisco, right, also had a super fancy dinner at
French Laundry. Well, he was at that dinner with Gavin Newsom and you know, everything else.
The rich have more resources than they think. They either have a history of being able to get away with stuff, or they think, I have enough resources that I can do this safely. But it's you poor people that can't, so you're the ones that have to hunker down. God, we say this every week. JB, everybody, you should set the example and you should suffer like everybody else, even though you don't have to. But my understanding is, as of today, Thursday, the vaccine is in the city of Chicago, that IDPH has it. And the only thing that's waiting now is the approval to literally put it in trucks and deliver it to Northwestern and Lurie, et cetera. There's five hospitals that have the super cold freezers, and they'll be able to actually start to distribute it. And when you talk to them, they say it'll be voluntary on the parts of the recipients, the healthcare workers on the front line, which is kind of interesting because you're just reminded over and over again that even the healthcare workers aren't 100% sure they want the vaccine. But I would sure take it. Austin, would you take it if I could give it to you tomorrow?
Maybe not tomorrow. I would take maybe wave two. It is amazing, though, how imminent it is. Our editor down in Belleville, Brad Weisenstein, his friends were in the trial in St. Louis, the Pfizer trial, and were given the vaccine. One was given the vaccine, one was given a placebo. And it's amazing how quickly that's been done and how it's here. And also something that's been encouraging to me recently was the optimistic projections of how quickly that they can get it out, you know, like 20 to 50 million people, not just doses, but people, being able to get access to this vaccine sometime before next fall is incredible to me. I mean, that might be overly optimistic, but it just seems almost surreal that that's upon us now.
Well, as I understand, these vaccines, they're based on the kind of technology that doesn't it's not like the vaccines that, that give you a little dose of the disease and then you fight it off and you're immune. But this is a, it's a totally different sort of technology. So that so the risk would be of sort of unseen side effects. Not that you would they would give you the shot and you would come down with COVID.
Right.
But I think I'm with Austin. I would definitely be in that second wave. I'm not a skeptic about this stuff. I'm just a little leery of something that's been rushed that quickly into production. And so once, you know, you see people going a couple months without or a couple weeks even without any bad side effects, then, yeah, because this can't end soon enough for me. That's for sure.
So I will embarrass my husband and say that he is absolutely in the same boat as you are, Eric, because he is also not a skeptic, but he is, you know, he's questioning the pace of this. And he was a little bit skeptical when I told him that the science of the approval process has not changed. It's like every other vaccine. What has changed is that the federal government said, hey, Pfizer, hey, Moderna, hey, AstraZeneca, here's literally billions of dollars. Go start making this vaccine before we even know if it works or is safe. And if it's not safe, or if it is safe, we will pay you either way. So it's really the time saving has not been on the science side of thing, but it's the fabrication side of it. It's the creation of the different of the doses. So that's what's different about this. And that's what Operation Warp Speed is. It's not warp speed on the science side of things, but it's warp speed on the, let's make this vaccine even before if we know if it's good or works or is safe. And we are prepared to trash it if it's not safe and these companies won't suffer financially for it. So he was skeptical of my explanation, and I think a lot of people will be skeptical, but I know I've said this before, is that before the polio vaccine basically eradicated polio, it was a very similar circumstance. And like, I'm not old enough to remember Jonas Salk, you know, immunizing his own son for the cameras, but that's what he did. So we're certainly going to need people with a lot of trust to take this vaccine to show people that it's safe. And I don't think it's, I think that's why we saw today that Presidents Obama, Clinton, and Bush said that they will be sort of among the first to take the vaccine to show people that it's safe.
Yeah, I mean, we were just told all year by Dr. Fauci and others that, you know, the fastest I've ever seen a vaccine come to fruition is 5 years. And so, we were all kind of like, oh my God, 5 years. And so now all of a sudden they say, oh, no, it's only been 9 months and we've got one. It's just one of those things that makes you really want to do your homework before you let yourself get injected. I also
50%, and you hope you get to 50%. Go ahead, Eric.
Right. Well, you don't, and there are always going to be anti-vaxxers, but we have to get to a certain percentage. Is it 50 or 70% of the population where essentially you have herd immunity? You're not going to totally eradicate the disease, but you're going to make it so that it's just going to be one of those risks that you take. That,
well, that's why I wonder, when you guys are saying you'd be on the second wave, what do you think is worse, getting COVID or getting some unknown side effect? You're not going to get COVID from the vaccine. Maybe you will suffer some side effect that we don't know right now, but we're all gamblers in this. And I think I would gamble on a side effect rather than on COVID. That's the devil I know.
Yeah, put on my Nassim Taleb hat, the Black Swan author. You'd want to look at what your biggest unknown risk is, which would be what the side effects would be, versus what, as far as we have some known risks of getting COVID, which I would say for my particular situation would be less than a potential insane side effect.
Yeah, well, you're young, you're healthy, so it would be easier for you to probably play that game, right?
Yes.
Well, I've moved my over-under date to July 18th now. I don't know if you guys are keeping track of this, but I'm July 18th, 11:45 a.m. is the all clear. I'm going to go outside my house with a air horn. The all clear. I've kind of been peppering you guys with this question, like, you know, there's no light switch. It's the tide we're talking about, but I'm thinking right around there. Eric, are you moving your date, or are you staying about the same time?
You know, the date that I have in mind is, you know, I play music out in Oak Park at the Farmers Market group out there, and we play indoors all winter, and clearly we're not going to be playing indoors this winter, but the Farmers Market out there, I think, opens maybe sometime in May, and I believe that by then we will be able to gather safely outdoors in May.
So, I mean, I think the big question about the vaccine is one that we don't know the answer to yet, is that we don't know if I get the vaccine and I get both doses, can I still spread COVID to somebody else? Now, I won't have COVID. I won't get sick and I wouldn't test positive for it. But because we know that this virus spreads asymptomatically, could I give it to somebody who hasn't been vaccinated?
Okay. And the people who, this is my, so I asked Dr. Most about that, the chief medical officer at Northwestern, that question, and he doesn't know. But his guess is that you can't, that the current understanding is that you can't. But I think that's a hell of a good question. And I wish he knew the answer 100%, and he doesn't.
And I expect that we'll know by March.
I'm still planning on going on a riverboat cruise in Europe in October, which would make some people shudder. I do it with some risk. You know, I mean, right now I'm thinking I'll go. It'll be safe. I'll bring my mask. Maybe at a cocktail party I'll wear it, although, God, a cocktail party with masks sucks. So
the thing about all the stuff is that I remember when we were shutting down and I was asking people about when they thought we were going to be doing this, that, and are we going to be playing football? Are we going to be playing pro basketball and so on? That there isn't really one answer to that we see how it sort of slowly rolls out. And the question of, I mean, to me, the acid test is going to be taking the L, right? How soon before you feel comfortable standing or sitting in a crowded L car for 20 minutes with or without a mask on? Let's say without a mask on. When are you going to feel comfortable sitting in a crowded L car without a mask on? What date's that going to be? I think that's a very different date than when you're going to be willing to gather outside.
Not July 18th, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, right.
Or 11:45 in the morning.
Or go to Wrigley Field. I mean, it seems to me that it'll probably feel pretty safe to be outside at Wrigley Field, whereas it might not feel safe to be inside a theater for a year or two. I think there are a whole bunch of rolling dates. I mean, I love the idea of an all clear date where the siren goes off and we all run out and cast off our quarantine robes. But I don't think there's such a date.
I still take the L, still take the red line. And as it's getting colder, there's more people on it now. I still want them to come up with a gadget, like a thing that detects radioactivities, that clicks when there's so many viral particles in the air. Why can't somebody invent that? And then you'd know if a room was safe, if a car was safe. That would, hell, somebody come up with that, man. Give $1 billion to Oxford for that.
As soon as you heard the clicks, it would be too late, though, right?
So. I think the that Scientology place on Lincoln has one of those.
Austin, you guessed it on my show this week, as did Heather, by the way, as did Mary Schmeek, Eric Zorn's colleague at the Tribune. Mike Madigan is still the Speaker of the Illinois House. And Austin described him on our show this week as maybe the most powerful state politician in the history of the United States. Do I remember that correctly? That maybe no statewide politician has ever wielded as much power as Mike Madigan has in Illinois.
I'll back Austin up on that. I mean, that's just a fact.
More powerful than any governor?
Yeah, just because of the longevity. So if you look at, I mean, he's the longest serving legislative leader in the history of the United States. And you think about the power he's consolidated, it's almost inevitable that he's been around that long. Of course, he's consolidated so much power. But if you just look at the procedural rules that he's able to wield, along with classic patronage, along with drawing the maps and things of that nature.
So I assume you had Austin on. I was listening to another radio station. I assume you had Austin on when Kathleen Willis, the House Democratic Caucus chair, announced that she was not going to vote for Madigan for to be speaker next session, which to my mind was just an absolute earthquake bit of news, because there were 18, I think, House members who had so far said they weren't going to, but none of them were part of Madigan's leadership team. None of them really signaled like, hey, it's over. And it's over now, I think. I don't see any way that he climbs out of this. Do you? Does anyone?
I mean, you can't topple somebody like Michael Madigan with nobody. So until there's somebody who is able to say, I can get to 60 votes, there's always the possibility, however unlikely, that people will come back home. and just say, look, we don't have any other options at this point.
I don't see it. I don't see it.
I don't think it's unlikely, but I don't think it's likely. But you can't beat somebody like Michael Madigan with nobody. Like somebody like a Greg Harris, like a Chris Welch, like, you know, somebody's got to step up and say, okay, his time is over. It's now my time. I'm going to consolidate this. And here's how I'm going to do it. We have not seen anybody make that case, and that's what I keep waiting for.
Well, we do have a critical mass of people that don't want him. Nobody has stepped up saying, and it should be me.
Right.
Well, no. One,
Stephanie Kiefelwood. But there's certainly been no, like, groundswell of I'm a Stephanie Kiefelwood, you know, Democrat or anything like that.
I think she's very unlikely. I don't think she's got that constituency. Yeah. But I think someone like a Greg Harris could step in. But the thing is, you have these 19 people, they're all on record saying they will not support him. And to go back on that would be just political suicide. They're not going to be reelected if they told their constituents, if they told the public, I'm not going to support Madigan, and then they come up with some cockamamie reason to support him. That's just not going to happen. So I don't see him getting those votes. I think that the smart thing for him to do would be to try to figure out how to engineer a successor pleasing to him. Austin, do you see there being a way for Madigan to hang on?
There's always a way, but he needs six flips. So there's 54 people remaining in the Democratic caucus who have not said anything about how they're going to vote, essentially. Some have said, I'm definitely voting for Madigan, but he's got 54 votes, assuming all the no's are out of the woodwork right now. Getting six people to flip on this vote seems impossible to me. But again, we're talking about a guy who's wiggled out of many things before. I would say it's almost certain that he will not be speaker this next session. It is virtually guaranteed that after this session, he won't be. But yeah, right now, I think what we're seeing is sort of a negotiation of a handing of the baton. We saw the Black Caucus actually announce a forum for speaker hopefuls, which is really interesting and is kind of reminiscent of when Madigan calls bills that he knows don't have the votes, because this is sort of, okay, come out. Like, who's coming, right? Like, who's challenging me? But the Willis announcement, I agree, has been the biggest defection so far, far bigger than any of the others, not only because she's on Madigan's leadership team, that opens up space for other people in leadership to look sideways at Madigan, but also because of her deep ties to organized labor in the state. And labor is going to go down with the ship with Madigan. They're going to stand with him to the very end. He's their guy. And the fact that one person who's closely aligned with him is speaking out against him is very significant.
I should point out that the image that Eric Zorn has chosen for this Zoom conversation is a silver monolith sticking out of some rocks that looks like is in Utah. Another one of those has been spotted in Romania and today in California. We don't have one in Chicago yet. I like the image, Eric. I'm a big fan of 2001: A Space Odyssey. So, and what a great sort of benchmark for the end of 2020, right? It's just been so freaking bizarre. I don't remember what happened in January, but obviously, you know, it's been marked by tragedy and strangeness. The first thing that comes to mind is Kobe Bryant's helicopter crash, the COVID all the way to the end, and this damn presidential election and recount. And so at the very end, these sci-fi monoliths are popping up around the world.
Someone said it's like God's version of Elf on a Shelf.
So I am 100% certain that this is some sort of weird marketing campaign, and we're all going to find out about it. And we're all going to be really, really angry for delighting even just the tiniest bit in this. And it's going to turn out to be like Tom Cruise's new movie or something.
Jesus.
I'm going to flip a table.
Or a diet supplement or something.
Something terrible.
I have been a little disappointed in the craftsmanship of the things. Like when they come up to them, welds don't look solid. They've got rivets. I don't know that space aliens have rivets. Some of the rivets are missing. They're hollow, for Christ's sake. I mean, they should be emitting a sound, and they should be solid and just a little more mysterious than they've been. And the first one was pretty good, but I'm a little disappointed in what we've seen since.
Evidently, there's some Google Earth images that show that at least one or two of these have been around for a while. like they've been discovered now, or people have publicized them now, but they've actually been there for a while.
John McCracken, right, is the artist who they think it is, who did this. And he had this crazy quote in a New York Times story. He told his son he would like to leave his artwork in remote places to be discovered later. And he had a lot of sculptures like this, which is just like, I mean, that's the coolest thing ever. If you're a sculptor, like that's amazing.
Is that the late John McCracken? Is he still alive?
No, he's dead.
Yeah.
For 10 years almost.
How neat if it has been literally sitting there waiting for us to discover it. And then it's the end of frickin' 2020. So that's its own bit of living art, isn't it? That's poetic in a way.
So, John, can we touch on Mayor Lightfoot's alleged gamble on the teacher strike?
Austin referred to this, I thought, last week, and I wasn't tracking. And I know, Heather, you followed the story, too. What's the story here?
So my colleague, Greg Pratt, over at the Tribune, got a hold of an email from the mayor's chief labor negotiator that was subject-lined confirming our agreement that basically set an over-under on how long the teacher strike was going to last, and that the winner would get cigars and scotch of their choosing. It's not a great look for the mayor to sort of be gambling on the future of Chicago's school children. But honestly, what caught my eye was the fact that the mayor's office redacted this email, refused to release it in full. And that decision was overturned by the attorney general's office that said, no, this isn't protected. You have to release it, which makes it the second time that the mayor's office has been overruled by the attorney general for not releasing information as required to the public. And for somebody who covered the mayor's 2019, bring in the light, I'm transparent, I'm a reformer, I am going to do things differently at City Hall, you know, I think that is far more newsworthy than this sort of scotch and cigars bet. And, you know, we all speculated about how long the teacher strike was going to last, right? It ended up being 11 days. But, you know, I think that, you know, there's an old journalism cliche that three things make a trend. So, you know, if you've got two things and you've got two sort of instances of the mayor not abiding by sort of the Sunshine or, you know, the Sunshine Act, you know, I think that's potentially problematic.
Can you refresh our memories about what the first one was?
So the first one tangentially involved me because the mayor sort of held these big conferences with aldermen during the worst of the rioting and the unrest on the South and the West Side. And we at WTTW got a recording of that meeting. And then later, our friends over at the BGA sued the city to basically say this was an illegal meeting under the Open Meetings Act, and the attorney general agreed. And the city basically said, okay, we'll stop doing it. Even though at first they insisted that it was perfectly acceptable, when, of course, anybody who has even a passing acquaintance with state law knows that you can't have a meeting of all 50 aldermen or a majority of aldermen and not tell the public. So that I think is probably more newsworthy than sort of the scotch and cigars of it all.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I thought that the bet, the mayor denied accepting the terms of the bet. She had the over and she would have won apparently, she denied this, and this was apparently the labor negotiator said something about, oh, this is just a joke that fell flat. I don't believe that. I think that they probably were putting a little side bet on it, and you do that kind of stuff in, you know, in pressure situations to relieve the tension and whatever. I get that people are there. It's a little bit of dark humor, whatever. But Heather's exactly right that the fact that they hid this, that there was an FOI request, and that they ruled that it fell under the exception. The exception is what for policy negotiations. I forget the exact language, but
it's procedural.
They allow exemptions for things that are, you know, basically if we're trying to figure out terms of a contract, whatever, those don't apply. This is clearly not that. This is just something they were embarrassed about. To throw the blanket of privilege over that is really troubling. And I think that's the story. The bet. I can't get exercised about the bet. I'll bet John Williams is, though.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, of course they don't want that to become public. I'm wondering what's the greater wound, right? Letting it go and everybody finds out, or hiding it. And then having to deal with the transparency issue. I guess neither of them are real attractive options, but you guys are telling me they picked the wrong path. Huh?
I can defend the bet. I can't defend the lack of transparency. That's how.
But the lack of transparency is over a stupid bet. They weren't hiding anything of consequence.
That we know of. But the way that FOIA works is that you have to ask specifically for what you want. So, like, if I knew they were hiding X, I could ask for X. But if I don't know X, I can't get it. So we literally don't know what we don't know. And the fact that they are, I don't want to say abusing, but are sort of willing to interpret these exemptions widely, I think that it makes it less likely that something of substance would be released to the public when it should be. And I think that's problematic. I am not objective on the, you know, on the ability of the public to see what city officials are doing. That is a good, and I think it's especially problematic because, you know, the Tribune and the BGA, to their credit, spent years battling Rahm Emanuel over his email and demanding that he make those emails public. And Lori Lightfoot campaigned against that sort of business as usual. And I think it's our job to hold her accountable for that.
The only thing I would add to the transparency point, it's not like it's a decision of transparency versus not. It's a bet on whether you're going to get overruled. And we all pay for that. So, like, we pay for the city law department to be defending Lightfoot for doing this. We pay for the attorney general to be asking for the documents. And so when they are obstinate about things that are going to get overruled, it hurts. It not only is it a transparency issue, it's like a taxpayer issue when they're doing things like that.
By the way, Austin, when you held up that book you were reading, can you hold that up again?
It's Damon Santola, How Behavior Spreads, The Science of Complex Contagions.
It's kind of book that Austin carries around with himself.
A little light reading.
I don't have my copy handy, but I just finished the biography of Jimmy Carter by Jonathan Alter. And I feel like I learned a lot about Jimmy Carter in the 1970s that I didn't know. It's called His Very Best. I recommend it.
We have the Obama book and I'm just starting it, but mostly we're just displaying it. It's which is what you do with some books. You go, yes, this is my team here. But since last week you did mention Michael Lewis's Fifth Risk, I'm holding up to the camera my copy of the Fifth Risk. And I've been trying to get him to come back on the show to talk more a little bit about transitions because that's pretty timely, but that's my bedside right now. How about you, Eric? What are you looking at these days?
I'm just reading the papers and cranking out columns right now.
You don't read, you don't like always have a book or two going?
I don't, unfortunately. I'm always
surprised to hear that.
I've got a stack of magazine articles that I'm trying to read.
Did you read the Sports Illustrated Michael Cohen, not that Michael Cohen, a different Michael Cohen piece on, he reached out to over 200 athletes who were invited to the Trump White House over the last 4 years. And he talks about what that experience was like. Joey Logano to the archery team at Syracuse or whatever, you know, I mean, it's quite a gamut. And what that experience was like. I thought it was very interesting because almost to the person, the people that at least agreed to be in the story said, it's the presidency. It's not the endorsement of the president. And these are very young people, right? So maybe their lives aren't as politically shaped as ours are, but they didn't say whether or not they were Trump supporters or haters, but given the opportunity to go to the White House, you go to the White House.
It's unavoidable, though, when you go to the White House, that it becomes a political statement that I don't think you can avoid it anymore. Trump has made it. Maybe it's not just Trump. Maybe it's always been this way. And there were certainly athletes who didn't go to Obama's White House, right?
Yep.
Sure. Yeah. I think that this argument falls apart when you realize that the Chicago Cubs had two White House visits for their World Series victory. They had one under Obama because, of course, he was president when it happened. And then they took another one after Trump was president. And of course, the owners of the Cubs are very pro-Trump. And I don't think you can make an argument that it's devoid of politics when the people involved are doing things like that.
But it did seem kind of unfair is not the right word, but for a lot of the athletes in the story were non-revenue sports. They were archery. They were rowing. Young people who, you know, have won the national championship in their life sport and nobody knows about it. And then they get a chance to go to the White House. oh, crap, Donald Trump's the president. But still, it's my chance to sort of, you know, put a bow on my athletic career and tell people about my sport. So that was the attitude that a lot of them had. Listen, I wouldn't take a tour of the White House, but I had a little more sympathy for the 20-year-old that did.
And they got
some fast food out of it, too, right?
You know, what was that? Was that the University of Georgia football team that won the national championship? But it was during the government shutdown.
Right.
And so, we shouldn't be fetting people too much. And so when the national championship football team, college team goes to the White House, Trump famously ordered up a bunch of fast food, and it looked ridiculous. That guy called every single athlete on that team and asked them to come on, and none of them would go on the record. So while I'm sitting here telling you that he found the athletes to be apolitical about it, it's telling that most of the athletes took a pass.
Do you see a difference, John, between someone who is involved in like rowing or archery or some sport that really doesn't get much attention, and how a visit to the White House would be an opportunity, as you said, to give some publicity to your sport, as opposed to, say, the national football champions who don't need the attention of the White House? It's not going to help the sport to have the president have you at the White House. So it's a different kind of calculation, I would think.
Maybe so. He did say, you know, they don't need the crap that would go with it either. Put that on your stack of magazines, Eric, to read.
Are you a regular reader of Sports Illustrated these days? Because my understanding is that it has really gone downhill in the last few years.
I hear that all the time. I'm not smart enough to know. It started arriving at our house. I think I'm paying for it. I'm not sure. And so now I'm reading it again. And I find it thoroughly entertaining. I enjoy it.
It was always just like the writing. I mean, I think you didn't even have to be a sports fan to enjoy the writing. It reminds me a little bit. I know we've spoken about the Queen's Gambit, about how you don't have to enjoy chess to love that show. And I think you'd never had to enjoy sports to appreciate the craft and the insight in the reporting that they did in Sports Illustrated.
What do you think of this bit we're going to do on the radio starting next week or the week after? I found a young person and a young woman in Chicago who's like a national chess savant. And so I'm going to play chess with her every day on the radio. We'll make a move.
Oh, that's exciting.
And then we'll have somebody else analyze it. Like, John has just moved his pawn to the Queen's Knight 4.
This will last about a week, John, by the way. It's any good.
Right. Not only will I not last long, but I'm not sure the audience will either. So I'm trying to not dwell on it too much, but America's playing chess right now. It's like crazy.
Well, you can put the image on your website, right? On the station website, it's this image of the board. So it's not just, I love that scene in Queen's Gambit when she's driving with Benny and they're playing chess in their heads and they're just talking and they're just rattling off moves and they just like can all picture the board. I don't think your listeners would be able to do that, but if you put the image on the web, you're able to follow this fascinating game.
Okay. Austin, thank you for joining us. Heather, Eric Zorn, I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. Play chess, everybody, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.